two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
A little over a week ago, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were sworn in as president and vice president. For many, it was a moment of hope after four stressful years of collectively holding our breath. In light of an administration that reinforced so many falsehoods and persecuted justice seekers, our country is in dire need of a reset.
When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
Execute. That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
Office of President of the United States.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
For Joe Biden, it was an oath 78 years in the making. Now the 46th President of the United States, alongside his history-making Vice President, Kamala Harris, the first woman, first Black, first South Asian VP.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all.
Dan Harris joins us this week to help us with that much-needed reset. Dan's a well-known journalist with ABC News who found meditation through a pretty circuitous journey. He's since written several books and even started a podcast called 10% Happier, all about the science behind meditation. In them, he explains how meditation helped him through the everyday stressors and the more significant existential ones that we can probably all relate to in one way or another.
The fear, the worry, the sadness, stuffing it does not make it go away. All it does is push it into some corner of your mind, from which vantage point it drives you blindly.
This is Our America. I'm your host, Julian Castro. In his early 20s, Dan Harris started his career at a local NBC affiliate in Bangor, Maine. By the time he was 28, he had landed his dream job anchoring and reporting the news with ABC. But in 2004, a video of Dan went viral that brought him an unexpected kind of celebrity.
At least 5 years may also lower their risk for cancer, but it's too early to prescribe statins slowly for cancer production. That does it for news. We're going to go back now to Robin and Charlie.
All right.
In front of millions of viewers on live TV, Dan experienced a panic attack. But instead of letting humiliation win, he turned to therapy and meditation. And in sharing his healing journey, he's helped people, like myself, reflect on those moments of panic, like speaking in front of large crowds on the presidential debate stage. Could you tell me about what led up to that? You arrive at that moment, and I want to ask about that moment, but what led up to that?
Well, because I was so ambitious and so lucky, that combination, when I arrived at ABC News in the year 2000 at the tender age of 28, and all of a sudden I'm working with people like Peter Jennings and Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters, I was really insecure about how green I was. And I had this motto that was bequeathed to me by my dad. The motto is, the price of security is insecurity. Which is a great thing to tell your kids, by the way.
I will say, my dad's true, right? I mean, very often true. People that reach these places that all of us see as super confident and well put together, and they have all the ducks in a row actually inside. They're like that proverbial duck that's paddling a million miles an hour, under the water, just trying to keep up and having self doubt and so forth.
Yeah, I think anxiety is quite common and among high achievers. And You know, we can talk about it. My views about the importance of anxiety to success have kind of morphed over time. And the question of, like, how important is anxiety in order to succeed was really one of the animating questions of the book I wrote called 10% Happier. And it was my views have changed over time. But suffice it to say, my dad had this expression that he gave to me. In his defense, he wasn't trying to venerate worrying. He was actually trying to make me, as an anxious kid, feel better about the worrying I was doing anyway. But so I at that point in time, I just kind of was super ambitious and very insecure. And then shortly after I arrived, 9/11 happened. And I raised my hand and volunteered to go overseas. And I ended up in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. And I got a lot of experience in war zones. You know, I was kind of driven by journalistic curiosity and idealism and then a lot of raw ambition. And when I came home, I got depressed and I didn't know I was depressed. I was just feeling awful. And I did something incredibly dumb, which is I started to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine. And even my drug career, I should say, was pretty unspectacular. It was, you know, short-lived and intermittent. It wasn't like I was getting high all the time. And I wasn't high the day I had the panic attack in June of 2004 on Good Morning America. But after I had the panic attack, I went to a doctor who pointed out that even though my drug use was pretty limited, it was enough to change my brain chemistry and make it more likely for me to freak out.
Hmm. And talk to me about that moment. Being on the air was nothing new to you. Most people, if they see that moment, you know, they may not even notice a huge change. I watched it. I watched the video, and it somebody could confuse that with you being confused about which direction the script was going in or the teleprompter went off. And we've seen that before as well. What happened? What did it feel like? And what happened afterward?
You know, you're absolutely right. And if anybody who wants to see the video, if you just Google panic attack on television, it's the first result, which is awesome. But anybody who views that and has never had a panic attack is likely to think, oh, you know, it doesn't look that bad. If you've had a panic attack, then most likely you know exactly what you're looking at. Just to step back for a second, as horrible as the situation was, I did have some luck. So in the moment that I was freaking out, my job that morning was to fill in as the news reader. That's the person who comes on at the top of each hour and reads some headlines off of the teleprompter. And we don't have that job anymore. But at that time, the job was filled by Robin Roberts, who's now the main host of Good Morning America. And I was filling in for her, and I'd done it many times before. I didn't have any reason to feel like today was going to be a bad day. But a few seconds into my spiel, I was supposed to read 6 or 7 stories, and I just, my lungs seized up, my heart started racing, my palms were sweating, my mouth dried up. I was having trouble breathing, which is a prerequisite for talking, which is a prerequisite for anchoring the news. So it was all pretty inconvenient. And as my body was freaking out, my mind started to freak out. And that became a vicious cycle of the more my mind freaked out, the more my body freaked out, the more my body freaked out, the more my mind freaked out. This is where the luck kicked in, though, because I wasn't out there solo anchoring the way Albert Brooks was in broadcast news. I had other anchors I could toss it back to. And that's what got me out of the situation. I tossed it back to Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer, and they took it over. So what you would have seen was a full-on meltdown or me ripping off the mic and diving into the desk, but I had the luxury of just squeaking out, back to you.
Well, and, you know, for most people, just getting up and speaking in public is the thing that they fear the most, right? And so here you are anchoring, you know, or news reading to millions of people. When people think about the prospect of having a panic attack in front of millions of viewers and the idea that they would have this moment where you would probably feel, I would think, embarrassed, maybe like you let folks down. I'll give you one from my own past. I remember having a conversation with President Obama at a reception that we were having. I think it was the last year that we were there. I was in the cabinet. He was in his last year as president. We were talking about our DNC speeches. He gave the keynote in 2004. I gave the keynote in 2012. And I told him that about 20 or 30 seconds into the speech, I felt like I was going to pass out in front of the 25 million people that were watching But you can feel that road that you're going down of not being able to breathe right. And then you start, as you say, it's a vicious cycle. You start freaking out in your head about, oh, you know, it's going to be embarrassing if I start to visibly look like I'm going to pass out. Years earlier from that, when I was on the city council in San Antonio, I went through this time period probably of about 6 to 9 months where not in every outing, but, you know, in a few of them, I would be sitting down as a city council member at an event, and something about being up on a stage in front of a crowd, not even getting ready to speak, just in front of a crowd, it felt like everybody was looking. And I would start to get anxious and nervous, almost like a mild form of agoraphobia. I say that to say that, you know, it's not uncommon with people, but you never know it. But you were there right in front of millions of people, and they did come to know it in part because you had the strength of character to talk about it and to try to make something good of that in your own career and to help other people. So, you know, tell me a little bit about picking up after that and how this journey to embracing meditation and then proselytizing, if I can use that word, you know, how did that happen?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about all that. I'm glad, by the way, you said what you said about your own personal experience, because I, you know, have watched you in public many, many times. I remember that speech in 2012, and I have watched you in the debates. I think the more people get up and normalize anxiety, the better it is, because it's such, you know, what we're talking about now, like a high anxiety panic and a heightened situation, you know, that's very, very normal. But even more normal is just sort of day-to-day anxiety that people, so many Americans, so many just humans live with. And to answer the question, after I had the panic attack, I went to a shrink and, you know, he pointed out that it was the drugs. So I quit doing drugs and agreed to go see the shrink on the regular for an indefinite period of time. Everybody asked me, you know, what happened? And I said, I don't know, which was a lie because I knew what had happened. It was a panic attack. In fact, when I went backstage, my mom called me and said, you just had a panic attack. So I knew what had happened, but I did not have the guts to tell the truth to my employers. And in my slight defense, in that moment, I had no idea I had anything to do with the drugs because, again, I wasn't using drugs that morning. So I just thought it was a fluke. And I was able to go back on the air an hour later, and I was fine. And so I think I kind of just got away with it. No, I know I kind of got away with it. I didn't admit the whole truth until a decade later when I wrote a book called 10% Happier. And I was very worried that it was going to ruin my career, that, you know, general managers of TV stations in, well, I don't know, Waco, Texas and Boise, Idaho wouldn't want me broadcasting on weekend mornings into the living rooms of their good families in the area because of my checkered past and et cetera, et cetera. I was really worried about this. And out of my relationship with this doctor, and because my boss, another boss at the time, Peter Jennings, had assigned me to cover faith and spirituality, which is a whole long spiel that I'll spare you from. As a consequence of those two things, I ended up stumbling upon meditation as something that can be useful. And my initial reaction to the notion of meditation was deeply hostile. I, you know, was constitutionally not able to believe in anything I can't prove, and I thought meditation was a religious thing and weird and, you know, for hippies and people who would like live in a yurt and are really into, you know, Enya. But then I found, and this is like the first time in my life I've ever really been ahead of a trend. So I noticed that there was a ton of science that suggested that meditation is really good for you. This was about 2008, 2009, so it was before meditation got cool. And I realized a couple of things. One, oh, I should try this because, you know, I've been struggling with anxiety and depression my whole life. And two, this is a really good story because nobody's talking about this. You know, these issues of anxiety and depression and substance abuse, and they're just so widespread in America right now. And so it's kind of like proselytizing for sort of a healthy practice that can, you know, mitigate against some of the pernicious effects of these very, very, very common conditions. And I had this entrepreneurial intuition that if I wrote a book and used the F word a lot and told embarrassing stories and really leaned on the science very hard, that I thought I could make meditation accessible to other skeptics. And so then that's why I wrote 10% Happier. And then everything that followed on from that has been really surprising, but awesome.
And first of all, that's a fascinating title, 10% Happier. I mean, you can get it, kind of get it, the idea that this can make you 10% happier. Why 10%? Why not 5%? Why not 20%?
You know, I had a lot of pushback. My publisher was actively trying to negotiate me up to like 20 or 30%. The reason why I stuck to my guns on that is it kind of grew organically out of my story, because there was an actual moment early on in my meditation career where I was talking to a friend of mine at ABC News, an old friend, and I mentioned to her that I had gone on a meditation retreat. And she was like, "What is the matter with you?" Bear in mind, this was before meditation is now reasonably, you know, socially acceptable, but it was not back then. And she was kind of making fun of me and saying, "Why are you doing this?" And I said, "I don't know, because it makes me like 10% happier." And I could see that the look on her face went from scorn to mild interest. And I thought, oh, okay, well, this is my shtick.
Huh. Yeah, you could tell right there that that's something that would resonate with people.
Yes, exactly. And to say, look, there is this practice out there. It's backed by science. It is secular. And it's not going to solve all of your problems, but it can make a significant difference. And by the way, the 10%, which again is kind of a joke and kind of not, I do like to say that it compounds annually, like any good investment. Meditation or working with your own mind is a skill. And so if, like, I handed you a flute right now, unless you already knew how to play it, it's highly unlikely that you would be able to bang out like a Jethro Tull solo. It would take a minute for you to learn how to play the flute. And so if I teach you how to meditate, which would take just a second because meditation is very simple, it would take years. It's just a skill you would generate over years. Not only the practice itself, but the application of the practice in your life. It's just such a rich and vast field. And so the 10% is really something that just grows in, I think, sort of unlimited ways.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
You've talked about your opinion that people should think of meditation the way that we think of sleep or eating or exercising, basically something that we should do on a regular basis for our health. But a lot of people, you know, like you say you were, they're skeptical. I mean, what do you say to the skeptics now that you've taken this journey from skeptic to somebody that's fully embraced meditation as a way to be healthier?
I love skeptics. Those are my people. So, if you're skeptical, that's good. Actually, I think it's good. This isn't, you know, some Ponzi scheme or some cult or anything like that where, you know, we're hoping that you dive in with you drop all of your critical faculties. I think skepticism is really healthy. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm a paid skeptic. But, I think there are a couple of things you can do. One is to just take a look at the science. Very, very strong evidence that suggests that meditation can lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system. And the neuroscience suggests it can literally rewire key parts of the brain associated with self-awareness, compassion, stress, focus, which is a huge issue in this era of, you know, technology and social media. A bigger problem that I kind of thought you were going to ask me about, and it is really just like now that meditation has, you know, a lot of the kind of the stink has gone off of it a little bit, a bigger issue I often run into, but I don't know if this resonates for you, is just people saying, I don't have time for this, or I can't find the time.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, we've gone through this pandemic. Most people's lives have been turned upside down. People are under stress. There are a lot of folks whose finances are under a lot of stress, who are maybe mm-hmm. facing eviction. A lot of parents right now that never imagined that they would have to be doing remote learning with their kids who are now at home. And also still doing their office job remotely through Zoom. And so the stress level seems to have gone through the roof. And at the same time, I think when people propose, whether it's meditation or, hey, why don't you get out to go to the gym and exercise? People are like, ugh, you know, where do I find the time to do that? How do I even start? So how does somebody start?
It's hard to ignore the amount of pain there is, physical suffering and unbelievable mental suffering and inconvenience and political mistrust and recrimination. There's just so much going on that's really hard. And so, yeah, how do you get started here? So I think I have good news. Everybody wants to know what's the least amount of meditation I can do and get the advertised benefits. And, you know, I've asked a lot of people in the scientific community, what's the sort of minimum dosage? And that is not a number that has been cracked, and I suspect it's different for everybody, but I've been able to generate something of a consensus among the scientists with whom I've spoken that if you were doing 5 to 10 minutes a day, you really should be able to get a taste of, you know, the calm, the focus, the lowered emotional reactivity. You're not as yanked around by this inner conversation that you're having, this sort of voice in your head that if we broadcast aloud, you would be locked up. That voice that we all know that chases us out of bed in the morning and has us constantly thinking about the past or the future, that voice can be managed really quite effectively in just a few minutes a day. But I would say, given how hard it is to form habits, and we know this, you know, we are not wired as a species to easily adopt healthy habits. You know, evolution didn't care about whether you flossed your teeth. Evolution cared about you getting enough food and sexual partners to get your DNA into the next generation. It really wasn't about your contentment levels. So as a consequence, I think just knowing that it is hard is actually liberating, because then you can go into the process with a sense of lightness and experimentation, and you can set the bar low. And so to set the bar low, what I tell people is 1 minute counts. If you're doing 1 minute a day and then maybe ramping up from there, that I think would be enough. That 1 minute is enough of an engineered collision between you and the inner cacophony that is mostly owning you that allows you to not be so owned by the inner cacophony. When you see clearly the machinations of your own mind, you're not so yanked around by it. So that can happen in a minute. And the other little mantra I have is that daily-ish, you know, try to do it every day, but it, you know, some days you're just not going to happen, and that's cool.
And what have been the benefits in your life?
You know, the three benefits I talk about the most are, one is just an increased sense of calm. It's a bit of a misleading term, calm, because it's not like when you meditate, you're magically going to get calm in the session, because many sessions of meditation, I should tell you briefly what meditation entails. It's not complicated. Usually you're just kind of sitting quietly and trying to feel your breath coming in and going out. And then every time you get distracted, you start again and again and again. Often that is a highly enervating activity because you're going to get distracted over and over and over again. And many people assume the moment they've become distracted that they're failed meditators. But in fact, the moment you notice you've become distracted, that is proof that you're meditating correctly. Because the whole game here is not to clear your mind, which is impossible. The game is to get more familiar with the way your mind works so that your random thoughts and urges and emotions aren't owning you all the time. So I find that even if my meditation sessions themselves are not calming, by pulling myself out of the sort of mindless forward momentum of my day, I've got a big injection of calm into my life. So that's the first benefit. The second benefit is focus. Because what you're doing in this exercise, again, is trying to just focus on your breath for a few nanoseconds at a time. And then every time you get distracted, start again and again and again. And this has been shown, you can see it on the brain scans, it changes the part of the brain associated with attention regulation. And then the third benefit is mindfulness, which is a kind of self-awareness that gets generated if you sit and watch your mind, try to focus on your breath, and then every time you get distracted, you're going to notice, like, what is your mind all about? It's humiliating. You're going to see plans for lunch. Do I need a haircut? You're going to be practicing in expletive-filled speeches. You're going to deliver to your boss. You're going to be maybe planning a homicide, whatever. You're going to see all of this uninvited junk. And that is a really healthy thing to do, as humiliating as it sounds, because the visibility is kryptonite for the junk. So mindfulness is the ability to notice when you're getting angry, for example, without taking the bait and acting on it. That's incredibly useful because then, you know, you don't, you know, pop off and say something that ruins the next 48 hours of your marriage or eat 78 Oreos because you have some sense of what's happening in your mind, some self-awareness, and then that gives you some distance, a choice, really. So you can respond instead of reacting.
But I think that's such an important point that, you know, people often think about meditation and I think that, oh, I'm going to, as you said, some folks think it's about clearing the mind or no longer having these random thoughts. People are always going to have random thoughts, but it's about understanding those and understanding their significance and being able to focus beyond that. That's the kind of benefit that you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately what you see is that thoughts are just thoughts. They're little more than nothing, as my meditation teacher likes to say. You know, there's a great expression from another meditation teacher. The thought of your mother is not your mother. Like, just because you're, you know, thinking about your parents and you're getting angry or whatever, these are just little, like, quantum bursts of energy in the mind. They're not necessarily connected to any reality. You didn't invite them. And so when you start to get some distance from your habitual thought patterns, your ancient storylines that are driving so much of your behavior, then you've got this space, this freedom to make saner, clearer, wiser decisions. It doesn't work all the time, but when it does work, it's magic. And this is a skill that you can generate over time. So you get better at doing meditation on the cushion or, you know, the formal practice, but then you also get better over time at being able to notice some powerful urge that's coming over you and not acting on it in a way that you later really regret. I think it comes down to, like, how much unhappiness are you willing to live with? How's it working for you to stuff your emotions? I mean, if you think about it, the fear, the worry, the sadness, all of these difficult emotions that are non-negotiable once you've been born, stuffing it does not make it go away. All it does is push it into some corner of your mind from which vantage point it drives you blindly. If you think about it clearly, what is better? Taking a look at what's going on for you so that you can manage it and so that you can be the most effective you can be in your job, as a parent, as a spouse, or letting all that stuff simmer in the background and make you do things that make you and everybody around you miserable. It doesn't seem like much of a choice to me.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And we would like to invite you on a hilarious and heartfelt journey each week on The Deep Dive. From navigating the chaos of motherhood and family to exploring the depths of grief and loss, we are just two best friends who process life together and with you guys. Discover our secrets to finding joy amidst the madness and get ready for unfiltered conversations about life, love, and everything in between. And nails. We talk a lot about nails. Now, community is everything to us at The Deep Dive. We believe in the power of connection and the strength that comes from supporting one another, and we would love to have you with us. So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Part of this Our America podcast, really the principal idea behind it is to focus a lot on people and on issues that are often left behind. You know, at the end of the day, what you and I are talking about is a concern for people's mental health. And if somebody has a broken leg and they have a cast on, right, everybody, oh, you know, are you okay? How are you doing? How can I help you? And we know that somebody got medical care at a doctor to take care of that. But there's so many millions of people in this country and around the world who are walking around with mental health issues that are addressable, that are treatable, and that deserve to be treated, but they don't get that. Some of those include, you know, the kind of anxiety that could be helped by taking up something like meditation. Talk to me about, as you've gone through this journey and you had, you know, that episode of anxiety, what you've seen about what we need to do on mental health in America.
Well, first of all, to agree with everything you just said, it's a huge issue. We're at, I believe, unprecedented levels of anxiety, depression, suicide, drug abuse. It's, you know, not only a personal tragedy for everybody who's dealing with these things, particularly at the more severe end of the spectrum, but it's a public health issue. And I am not a meditation fundamentalist or supremacist. I don't think meditation is the answer to everything, but I do think it can really help. And we've seen it in so many contexts, in schools, in prisons, in juvie halls, in foster care. And, you know, this capacity, mindfulness, the capacity we all have to view our thoughts from with some distance. This is a birthright, an innate capacity that every human being has. And in our culture, we don't really teach people how to generate it. But there is this simple, free technology called meditation that I think it would be great if we started doing a better job of prioritizing it, because we're seeing the deleterious effects of ignoring public health. And it shows up in the forms of kids committing suicide and of parents so ensorcelled by their addiction that they can't take care of their kids, and regular, you know, otherwise highly functioning Americans who are just living lives of quiet despair from anxiety or depression. It's just all over the place. And again, this isn't going to, you know, meditation isn't going to solve everything, but it really can be helpful.
Over the last almost a year now, our country and our world has been on quite a roller coaster, public health-wise, economically, politically, in terms of the polarization. What makes you hopeful? What are you hopeful for in 2021?
Look, I think I'm not saying anything. I'm not breaking any news here. I think we're heading into some probably very difficult months. But I'm very hopeful. You know, I'm married to a pulmonologist who knows quite a bit about COVID. And so I think, you know, based on my conversations with her and other experts in the field, I am pretty hopeful about these vaccines. And I do think we're going to head into some tough months, but I also think what we've seen around the speed and apparent success of this process around creating these vaccines may be one of the greatest scientific triumphs of all time. And so that it does give me some hope. Another thing that gives me hope, and it has nothing to do with, it's not tied in any way to current events, but it is sort of the thing that gets me up in the morning and allows me to sort of put myself through the torture of trying to write more books and all of that stuff is I am kind of an evangelist for meditation. And if I'm an evangelist, my good news or my gospel is that the mind is trainable. All the qualities of mind that you want, happiness, calm, self-awareness, connection, gratitude, generosity, all of these qualities of mind, they're not factory settings that are unalterable. They're skills that can be trained through meditation and other modalities. And that is incredibly good news. Happiness isn't just something that happens to you. It is a skill that you can take responsibility for. And so to me, that gives me a ton of hope. You know, I've been thinking a lot and sort of following the debate on Twitter and elsewhere. There's been a very interesting debate because you see some people, kind of center left folks, coming out and saying, you know, now is the time where we need to try to have some empathy for folks who voted for Trump. And then you see pushback from folks who say, you know, that's a privileged argument. And I have sympathy for both sides of this debate. And I think it's, you know, to a lesser extent happening on the Trump side, too, of like how much should we try to kind of reach out to our neighbor or you know, or does anybody who voted against Trump represent sort of an existential threat to the republic? And this is our country. We're all sharing this chunk of land circumscribed by a border. And I think there's some need to understand to get along with one another. And so I just wonder where you put yourself in this debate.
I mean, that is my hope. My hope is that President Biden and also obviously Republicans in the Congress and then people at an everyday level can find ways to lower the temperature on polarization. And I do think that at the local level, especially, you can actually get past a lot of those barriers that people have put up. Now, we've also gotten a lot more polarized over the last, I don't know, decade. But I still hold out hope that we can find a common sense of identity and purpose, because I think that's what's become missing in this country to a large extent, like this sense of common purpose and identity for the country. We have, I think, in my opinion, you know, leaders like Trump that don't make it any easier. You have a total segmentation of media. People are not experiencing the same thing. And then online, they're experiencing tailored versions of reality, even more so than on broadcast. But oddly enough, I actually believe that this COVID experience in some ways lays the groundwork more for us to come together. Because like it or not, everybody has had to deal with it. And I think the question for leadership and for people at an everyday level is, okay, well, you know, how do you use the experience that we've just been through in a constructive way to hopefully start putting the pieces back together of this common sense of purpose and identity? Having an open mind and an open heart is a prerequisite to that.
I mean, you said a lot of things there, but one thing in particular that I agree with is that having some sort of understanding of people with whom you disagree does not mean you have to abandon your principles. And I feel like there's a lot of fear that somehow if I can reach some sort of understanding of my neighbor who voted differently than I voted, that it's going to jeopardize my core values. And I don't see it that way. I just think that understanding seems like a prerequisite for cohabitation, and we don't have any choice but to cohabit here in this country. And so, yeah, but it's thorny, but I'm glad to hear you express some optimism.
I'm hopeful, you know, that we can get to a better place. I think we will. Thank you for taking the time to join me, and thanks for what you're doing, and a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I hope this conversation helps you to find a bit of calm and mindfulness of your own to start off 2021 with a new perspective. I'd like to leave you with the same question Dan asked me. How can we as a country fight polarization without sacrificing what we believe in? If you'd like to send me your reflections, you can email our team at ouramerica@lemonadamedia.com. That's ouramerica@lemonada.com.
Next week, we're joined by another journalist who is also named Dan. You might know him as the storied CBS News anchor who covered some of our country's most important historical moments, like the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, and Watergate.
As we now take on a new administration in Washington, it's a reckoning of saying to ourselves, who are we? What have we become? We cannot afford another 2020. So in that way, it's one of the more decisive years in the history of the country. I know that journalists are prone to say this almost every year, but in this particular year, I think it has the added advantage of being true.
Our America is a Lemonada original. This episode was produced by Julia Yort. Jackie Danziger is our supervising producer. Keegan Zema is our technical director. Music is by Hannes Brown. Executive producers are Stephanie Whittleswax, Jessica Cordova Kramer, and Julian Castro. Help others find our show by leaving us a rating and writing a review. Follow us at Lemonada Media across all social platforms. Or find me on Twitter at Julian Castro, or on Instagram at Julian Castro TX.
Lemonada.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere? And suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time. Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.